Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we engineer weird and wonderful science irradiated directly into your ears. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, Andrew Despy from Akin talks about a kinder, gentler transhumanism. First up, here's news of smaller, cuter commercial nuclear power. Small nuclear? The Australian government, in its war on renewable energy, has started a parliamentary review into nuclear power again. The last review by experimental nuclear astrophysicist Ziggy Switkowski concluded that nuclear power stations are so horrendously expensive that only a tax on carbon dioxide emissions would enable them to make a profit in the same market as the much cheaper coal power stations. That was the end of that for 10 years. Now the Minerals Council of Australia are talking about small modular nuclear reactors. This is the same mining industry lobby group that varnished a lump of coal for Prime Minister Scott Morrison to take into Parliament to wave around as a prop without visibly getting his hands dirty.
Mr. Speaker. This is coal. Don't be afraid.
The Treasurer knows the rule on props.
It's coal.
Ziggy Switkowski was interviewed by Sabra Lane on AM on ABC Radio National in August, where he said that he supports small modular nuclear reactors for Australia, just like President George W. Bush, former Prime Minister Bob Hawke, and former Prime Minister John Howard.
There's no question that the renewable solar and wind in particular have become very cost effective, and the outlook for battery storage is promising, but it's not with us yet and it may be some years away. And I think these small modular reactors, so the reactors that hitherto have powered nuclear subs and icebreakers, about a tenth the size of a regular big power station, they look as if they'll be widespread in their deployment in the 2020s.
These small modular nuclear power stations would be made in factories and fueled with nuclear waste from the United States. The Americans import Australian uranium for their reactors and then would ship the nuclear waste to us, with the legal fiction of nuclear leasing. By an amazing coincidence, the American nuclear waste is also exactly what you need to process into fuel for nuclear weapons. It's dual purpose. This highly dangerous nuclear waste has to be shipped to Australia without being hijacked by terrorists. Then the highly toxic material has to be transported across the continent by truck, train and plane to the reactors that would be placed all around Australia without a single accident. The ridiculously dangerous radioactive waste that comes out the back of this small reactor, fueled by American nuclear waste, would then be Australia's problem, making Australia effectively the world's nuclear dump by stealth, safely far away from America. It's a con game of pass the parcel to make sure American corporations aren't left holding the radioactive waste. Australians are the suckers. Every attempt to commercialise domestic small modular nuclear reactors in the last 50 years has failed. Small modular nuclear reactors cost more than conventionally large nuclear power stations because they lose the economies of scale. A 250 megawatt small modular nuclear reactor will generate 25% as much power as a 1,000 megawatt reactor. But it will require more than 25% of the material and people, all the costs of one big reactor replicated for many small reactors. They will be more prone to accidents because the bugs haven't been worked out. The small nuclear reactors commissioned by Russia, China and Argentina are handmade instead of modular, over budget and behind schedule. The companies in the US and Canada that are interested in small modular nuclear reactors don't have any prototypes yet. At present, the intermediate level waste produced by Australia in the Opal Research Reactor at Lucas Heights legally needs to be stored deep underground. It's not. Instead, the intermediate level waste is stored above the ground, with Australian government plans to put this intermediate level waste, temporarily forever, into shallow, grave, near-surface storage in a low-level radioactive waste dump. Would you trust them with the very high-level radioactive waste from many small modular nuclear reactors? Ziggy Switkowski had this to say.
In Australia, the storage volumes would be small. It would be 50 years before we'd have to have a repository in place. Over that time, lots will change for the better.
So he's saying we should push the nuclear waste problem 60 to 80 years into the future. The Australian government has already failed to build a national low-level radioactive waste dump after more than 40 years of searching. Small modular nuclear reactors won't be using thorium as fuel, as thorium can't fission. You have to transmute thorium into uranium, and then you've just got a uranium reactor with all the problems of waste disposal and nuclear weapons proliferation. The last question for the new parliamentary inquiry will be, what could the government do to make nuclear power of any kind profitable in a market with solar and wind power that's now cheaper than coal and getting cheaper? Tax the sun? The Minerals Council of Australia would if they could. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. A kinder, gentler transhumanism? Andrew Despy is Director of Ecosystems at Akin, an artificial intelligence company based in San Francisco and Sydney. Akin's mission is to ensure the responsible co-evolution of humans and AI, which implies an otherwise irresponsible co-evolution of humans and artificial intelligence, as currently expressed in the futurist movement and philosophy of transhumanism. I began by asking Andrew, what is wrong with transhumanism?
I think transhumanism is a movement that is mainly focused around the technology community. And my problems with transhumanism are the same problems that I have with the technology movement in general and with the socioeconomic framework that gives rise to the technology that we all use. A concept that I find is very powerful and very compelling is this idea of the technium that Kevin Kelly talks about. So it's this idea that technology is the next stage in the evolution of life. It's our descendant as a superior, exponential, all-powerful new life form that is, in a sense, independent of us. And the examples that it gives are, you know, if you look at Moore's Law or any of the other metrics around the development of technology, it seems to be on an inexorable path that appears to be independent of any other human activity. Whether we're going through a recession or war, technology seems to advance continuously. And so one premise that you can develop from that is that technology will just always continue to develop independent of us, and that all we can do is to try and figure out where it's going and try and ride on its back in the most beneficial possible kind of way. But what to me, that argument fails to mention is the fact that there is actually a very explicable reason why technology is developing. And there is a scenario in which I could definitely conceive a world where technology isn't being developed. We know that we could develop nanotechnology, but we just choose not to, whether it be temporarily or forever, because the reality is that technology is a product of our society and the choices we make as a society. And if we lived in a society that consciously made these choices, there's no reason why we couldn't. There's been moratoria on all kinds of things that we can point to. The underlying fuel that is driving technological progress is capitalism. It's this symbiotic relationship between capital, technology driving greater productivity, being reinvested in technology development, and then that getting reinvested in capital. And that's basically this cycle that is unstoppable. That's why it's unstoppable. There's no reason why we as a society or a civilization couldn't make a decision to make some changes to capitalism itself and thereby slow down or in some way control this cycle. So to me, it's a false premise that technology is this thing that is just out there and we should all just basically ride on its tail and have fun into the future, into the technological singularity. To me, it's not that simple. And understanding the reasons why technology is developed and why we use it, I think is really important to helping us come up with a better framework to think about the future that we want to live in. So that's one problem that I've got with transhumanism. It's based on this techno-utopian premise that is all actually driven by capitalism.
My understanding is that there's all sorts of things driving the development of things like Moore's Law. So we started miniaturizing things because of the space program, which was an entirely government-funded enterprise at the time. They needed things to be small and light and fast enough to get them to the moon and all the other things that they were trying to do with little robots. And on the other hand, Moore's Law, of course, has only applied with the doubling of computer speed and the doubling of memory storage, because people worked really hard to try and keep to that schedule once it was pointed out, rather than lose the market share to say, oh, look, it's all failing, forget it. So I don't think technology just happens. I think people have to work really hard to make it happen. But Charles Stross, the Scottish science fiction writer, has suggested that corporations are slow artificial intelligence machines, using humans as components early on, but slowly getting machine parts. And their only real interest is in whatever they were set up to do, which is maximizing returns for shareholders.
There is an entire movement centered around how we can have futuristic organizations that are fully autonomous, that use humans as resources that can be eventually replaced with machines or algorithms. And again, even just that whole language that we use there of human resources, that again is something that comes out of the Enlightenment and is obviously, you know, at its core dehumanizing. It's looking at humans as a means to an end rather than the end in and of itself. So 100%, that's where we're going. What does that mean for humans then? Are we going to become enslaved and become the batteries that power the computers, like in The Matrix, or are we going to live in some sort of utopian fantasy, or probably more likely descend into a kind of balkanized, fractured virtual reality space where we all get to experience our own fantasies? That to me is a pretty, whichever way you look at it, it's a pretty dark future, because we're again starting with what is the best for corporations. How can we optimize corporations? If that's the premise of the way that we organize our planet, then it's very hard to imagine a future where we can reverse climate change, where we can replenish the natural resources that we've decimated and so on. There's nothing in that gives me deep sort of hope for the future generations. Again, that's not to say that it's necessarily a bad future, because there's some limitations to our current values as well that we might find down the track that we were misguided, and we shouldn't be too arrogant about our values today and so on. My whole point of view is that we should really start all of these discussions with humans, and with humans in the wetware kind of biological sense that we are still, and then figure out a way to create a global structure that enables a kind of cohesion and peaceful coexistence of this great diversity of the approaches to life, because there is no right approach or wrong approach. And I think we should definitely encourage diverse cultures to continue to exist. You know, again, global capitalist forces are driving us towards a global monoculture, which I don't think is good. But I also don't think that unnecessary tension between humans is good either. We should figure out a way that we can coexist. So my kind of utopian vision is one where technologically and cyborg enhanced humans that have got direct linkages in their brain to a super intelligence can happily coexist with people who choose to live a traditional tribal lifestyle, and the planet is shared, or the solar system is shared, to enable this kind of diversity and somehow managing the tension between all of these. That to me is like the big challenge for the next century or two.
So do you think a lack of diversity is one of the things that the transhumanism movement is missing? Just the diversity isn't there. It's just a particular mainly male, mainly white, and mainly wealthy corporate people.
That's definitely part of the problem. I mean, that's just the technology world in general. We've all been to technology events, and it's very hard to see real diversity, especially when it comes to gender, which is really disappointing. That also, though, we should remember, is a product of our particular culture. In other countries, it's definitely not the case. So I was born and raised in Romania, and where I come from, women have got an equal role completely when it comes to engineering and maths and technology and so on. It's the gender split is pretty much down the middle. And that's because being studious isn't stigmatized by that particular culture. It's encouraged, and there's no absolutely, you know, empowering women with knowledge and so on, and being able to be economically empowered is just something that's part of the culture. So we have to remember, in the Western world, we've got these cultural myths that we live inside of that are driven by media and reinforced through media and through our schools and so on. And that's another kind of one of the limitations that we live in. But when it comes to diversity, this diversity of ideas, I think, is what I'd like to encourage in the transhumanism movement. And the other side to what I think we should reconsider when thinking about transhumanism is not so much around the socioeconomic structure that drives our whole view on what the role of technology is and what transhumanism is and so on, but it's just the word itself. I have this kind of problem with the way that we somehow seem to settle on definitions of words and collectively forget about the broader meaning of the words that we use, and that severely limits thought, right? You know, words play a big part in the way that we think, and they're very powerful tools. And that's exactly my point. Words are tools. Language is a tool. Symbols, culture, numbers are a thinking tool, you know. You can very easily see how the development of the concept of numbers with the exact same hardware in our brains has enhanced us significantly in our ability to understand the world and to function and to survive. So I think of transhumanism as human enhancement, right? Definitely, through technology. But technology to me is the kind of key word there. And what I like to think about is what other kind of technologies are there that are already an extended part of ourselves. And so I like to look at these things backwards rather than forwards. It's very easy to speculate. It's also very silly to speculate a lot of the time about the future. other than to say what a desirable future is, and I've got lots of thoughts on that, but I'm certainly not going to say where the world's going to be 50 years from now or anything like that, other than the fact that there will be millions and millions of climate refugees. That's probably something you can't argue with. But if you look back to the relationship between humans and technology and the way that we've co-evolved with technology, you know, I think all the way back to Homo erectus, I think about the domestication of fire and the impact that had on human well-being, on human flourishing, and ultimately this comes down to the ability to survive, humans' ability to survive. So the domestication of fire became a really powerful tool in our ability to, for lack of a better word, colonize the planet, which obviously de-risked the survival probability of the species as a whole, because any impact to a local population could be contained and humans could continue to survive. And as we all know, there actually is an Eve that we all come from, that all modern humans are descended from this one woman, which is a pretty mind-blowing, staggering fact if you think about how close we must have been to extinction as a species. And so if you look at it that way, then the movement into space is a perfectly rational kind of extension of that trend. But the next big thing that I think happened was we figured out how to use fire to cook. And from what I've read, that led to a huge explosion in the size of our brains. It changed our relationship with our environment in terms of nutrition and how that then became a part of us. And then really the next really big explosion that we're aware of is the cognitive revolution that happened about 100,000 years ago. And again, this is kind of speculation, but the best theory seems to be that the development of modern language is what led to this entire modern human species that we're all a part of today. And what is that? You know, what is this modern language? As I said, it's symbols, it's metaphors. Metaphors are incredible tools because the world is really bloody complex, and metaphors help us understand the world. Obviously, they lead to misunderstandings as well and some false beliefs and so on, but they're an important survival tool. And what comes out of that is stories and storytelling. And that's when it gets amazing, right? If you think about how powerful stories are in shaping the way that we think, the way that we behave, the way that we feel. All of these things have had an immense sort of survival, have become an immense survival adaptation for us as humans. And so this is why I think when we're talking about transhumanism, I think it would be so much more fascinating to broaden our definition of transhumanism and to think about it from the point of view of, like, what's a cyborg? A cyborg is a cybernetic organism, right? Cybernetic doesn't mean digital technology. Technology doesn't mean digital technology. That's a whole nother pet peeve of mine, that if you do a Google search for technology, you can't find any results in the first few pages that don't relate to digital technology. It's as though we've forgotten about all the other kinds of technologies out there. But cybernetics is really about the study of feedback loops. It's about the relationships between things and how they influence those things. And it's been critically understudied. It's obviously bits of it got adapted into different fields of study. You know, a lot of the early AI work came from that, and it's been applied in microbiology and in a few other kind of fields, but hasn't been really applied in social studies too much yet. And I think that is where the really next big shift in our understanding of humanity will come from, is where we start to merge this whole concept of cybernetics with mimetics, so the study of humans as nodes in a network of sharing and spreading ideas. And I think when we get to that point, we'll have a much better understanding of self, because we can only exist as a function of a system. A man is not an island, right? I don't believe in that. And trying to understand that is what I've started to think about recently, what I'm focused on.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Despy from Akin, talking about technology and society in the future. Andrew will be back next week to explain where Akin fits into his vision of an artificial intelligence-led future. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter @IanWolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border Districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XX in Canberra, and my local station, 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.